spiritual self-care. So it's kind of like a five-part series on self-care. So tonight's on male self-care. I have to really watch it because this is my shtick. This is my thing. I love. Okay, so in college I was a philosophy major. You like to watch things, but I don't. That's what you get a lot. You like to talk about metaphysics. You like to talk about epistemology. That's the stuff we talk about. We had classes on that. We had classes on logic. We had classes on ethics. We had all kind of, you know, we could just go on and on. But in this room tonight, we have philosophers. Whether you call yourself that or not, there are philosophers here. Philosophers generally ask why. Why of life? Why do people do what they do? Why are we here? Okay, so we have philosophers here. But also in this room, we have pragmatists. Everybody know what pragmatic thinking is? How does something work? How do you make this thing work, you know? And if something's broken, how do you fix it? So we have philosophers here who are wondering why. We have pragmatic thinkers who are sitting here thinking, if something's broken, I want to figure out how to make it work. We have relational thinkers. We're all about, I wonder how so-and-so's doing. And they're always thinking, who this and who that. They're always, and I say that, I promise I'm not being sarcastic. They're always up in somebody's business. But I don't mean that in a bad way. They really, genuinely care about other people. And when they start a conversation, that's generally where it goes because that's the way their mind goes. So we have philosophical thinkers, you know, scratching their chin, wondering why. Pragmatic thinkers, very detailed, very, you know, want to get these small things done just right, fix just right. We have relational thinkers, want to hug you, want to talk to you, want to check your pulse. We have responsible thinkers who always think in terms of projects and responsibilities and shoulds and oughts and, you know, they're perpetually obligated to something. And so they're always figuring out, what should I be doing? What I ought to be doing right now. Could go with morality, could go with relationships, could, how should I be feeling right now? What should I be thinking right now? It's more, thinking goes along the lines of responsibility. So, you know, they've got these, I'm going to say this wrong, Enneagram? Did I say that right? They've got these, that's the latest thing, but they've had these things forever. They check how you think, they check your personality, they check your character traits, they check all this stuff. Well, I just came up with my own list. Mm-hmm. About how we think. These are different kinds of thinkers. Now, when I named that off, some of you all here said, well, I'm a little bit of that. Well, I'm that too. And well, I'm that too. And I think we all are a mix. But I think that every human probably has a little bigger number in one of these areas than they would in the other three. I know Wayne and I used to, it was all in good fun, but people criticize us all the time because they said, you all think, both of y'all think, in such philosophical terms, how do we do that? You know what I'm saying? We hear what you're saying, but how do you live that? How do you carry out what you're thinking? And so we're all the time talking together, okay, we've got to figure out some way to explain how what we are thinking about is lived out in practical, because we were philosophical thinkers. So you kind of get the idea. Everybody thinks about life a different way, and I don't think we learned that. I think that we're kind of born that way. I think it may change and shift a little over time, but it's kind of the hand you were dealt at conception when it comes to those things. If you got yourself kind of paid, when I give you those four options, you can kind of find yourself in that mix a little bit. I've told you about this before, but there's a very formative book that I read in college. It was a philosophy class. We were required to read it. It was a guy named Richard Weaver, and he wrote a book called Ideas Have Consequences. And I've mentioned that several times in here. The title of that book alone has impact. The content of the book was very impactful to me. But when ideas get started in our thinking, whether we're philosophical, pragmatic, relational, or responsible, any of those, when ideas get started, they go somewhere. Most ideas are not just dead ideas. They begin. So our brains have to process ideas. Some ideas are caught when we're little. They're not really taught. You just catch them in the room, you know. Some are taught, just outright taught. Some of them, many of them are developed in an early age. Some of the ideas that we develop are literally essential for our survival when we're little. If you come up in a traumatic or stressful situation, you develop ideas that just help you survive. So, but ideas are, they're developed in your brain. They're not dead. Does everybody understand what I'm saying? They don't just sit there. They grow. They go somewhere. So ideas have consequences. And over time, these ideas, I'm not, you've got to forgive me because I was a philosophy major, so you've got to forgive me. But these ideas develop into presuppositions. Does everybody know what a presupposition is? Where you presume something before you really have all the information. But if you're raised with certain ideas and the seeds of these ideas are planted in your head and they develop, they don't stay dead, they develop over time. And so these ideas become your presuppositions to life. And if you want to give a picture to it, they become lenses over your eyes. So everything that you view in life have to go through the lenses of these presuppositions or these ideas. And so take five of us out of this room and we go down to the square and there's something happening there. I don't know. Somebody is a play. They're carrying on a play on the square down in Bowling Green. And five of us go. And every single one of us, of the five, are going to see that differently. We're going to hear the words differently. We're going to see the characters differently. That we're going to experience the coldness, the outdoorsiness of it, everything about it, the lights, everything. We're going to experience it different because we're going to look at it through different lenses that have been developed over years because we've developed these ideas. Is this getting just like totally weird?
It's like the opposite.
We're going to go somewhere with this, I promise. So we have these lenses that we have. Okay, so here's where recovery comes in. Some of these lenses that were developed, I'm going to go to my story, okay? Some of these lenses that were developed in me when I was a kid, whoever developed them, I could go back and just hug them and kiss them. I'm so thankful for some of the ideas that were planted, that grew, and became some of my presuppositions and some of my lenses through which I view life. Because even in recovery, I've realized those were good ideas and good presuppositions to carry through life. They've not just served me, I'm going to use big words here, but they've not just served me well pragmatically. They've served me well relationally and philosophically and theologically with my relationship. They've proven themselves to be true and good and solid. So some ideas are good. They don't need any recovery. They don't need any healing. They don't need any reprogramming or readjusting or cleaning or anything like that. But here's where recovery comes in. Some of the lenses that have developed over time due to the ideas that were planted early are really taint our view of reality. And we do not see life the way it is. We see it through faulty lenses. We think about certain things and process certain things because we have false presuppositions and they're not really literally the same as they were when they were given to us when we were little. They've grown. They've gotten bigger. They've gotten more complex. They've gotten more invasive in the rest of our thinking. And so some of these false presuppositions or bad lenses are causing us to see life. We're not seeing life the way it really is. We're seeing it wrongly. So what do we do about that? So here's where we come to the mental self-care. That was all the introduction, by the way. Now we get to the real thing that we need to talk about. So what about mental self-care? Let's go to a cliche. A recovery cliche that is so true. If nothing changes, nothing changes. So if we continue to feed that presupposition, and we can mean, once you realize you've got it, once you're in it, because a group like this is so loving, but in a way, unforgiving, in that if you've got some faulty presuppositions, you're going to hear about it. You're just going to hear about it in somebody else's story, or you're going to have a recovery partner who has the backbone to say, "Can we talk?" And they're going to tell you, you know, some of the ways that you're seeing life. You might want to rethink that. You might want to revisit that. You know, so in recovery, if nothing changes, nothing changes. So, how do we do this? How do we get these bad lenses corrected? How do we get these faulty presuppositions fixed? These are just a few ideas. It doesn't mean that all of the ideas, and some of these are just my opinion. But I think the first thing we do is we keep coming back here. We expose ourselves to a variety of viewpoints. And if you go to the, I call it the big church, if you go to the big church, you basically hear one viewpoint, and it comes from the pulpit. There's nothing wrong with that. That's okay. But we need to be involved with a group of people where person A can say, "This is my viewpoint." Person B can say, "This is mine." It's not the same as person A. And everybody has a different viewpoint. It exposes you to a reality that is far bigger than yours, that's in your brain. It exposes you to a world that is not nearly as nailed down as you thought it was. It exposes you to a lot of thinking that has a lot more gray to it than just black and white. And it helps you realize, whoa, I've been locked into this mental system. I've been locked into this way of thinking things. I need to really pay attention to what my brothers and sisters are saying. It may not all be right. It may not all be right. But the simple act of exposing yourself to the possible legitimacy of other people's opinions. And if we just cut them off, the first three words of that sentence, then I'm done. I'm not going to listen. They punch three buttons that shut me down. We'll never learn that way. But if we come in saying, I'm gonna tell myself that everybody has a valid viewpoint and a valid opinion until it's proved just like totally, totally wrong.
I was to say that.
Never mind. So we expose ourselves to all these different people and different ways of thinking here. And this is the only place I've found where this is just like the rule of the day. It's not the exception, it's the rule. It happens other places, but it's usually the exception. But here, it's the rule. Some of y'all are going to say, "Well, duh, we already knew this stuff." But if you're a reader, read books, watch shows, documentaries, shows that educate, but not when we shop for books and when we watch shows, when we scan through watching for shows, don't we generally pick things that we say, "This kind of agrees with my viewpoint. This kind of goes with the way I already think. Oh, that looks interesting. That's something I will like." Sometimes it's good to expose yourself to the exact opposite viewpoint that you have. Force yourself to say, "I'm going to look at this whole thing that I think I have my mindset on, I'm going to look at it through the completely opposite viewpoint." I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, I decided that I had been drinking from one cup my whole life. That I had just basically followed the company line of the company I was born into. Theologically, politically, culturally, in every way, I just was drinking mindlessly from that same cup. And so I decided I'm going to start exposing myself to the what I would, at that point, consider the opposing point of view. I'm going to start exposing myself to that. It's amazing what happened. I was a strong Republican. I'll let you write. A strong, strong Republican. And I started listening to the far left. I'm hurting. I mean, far radical left started listening. Couldn't go there. But what I found is it pulled me to the middle. stands for what I believe now. But that would have never happened if I hadn't researched the other side. Theologically, I started hanging out with Wayne Hunter. He's like, I don't want to drink the company line anymore. And he said, well, I don't either. And, well, do you think there's an alternative? Do you think there's another option? We said, well, let's see. So we started just exploring, and we started reading authors that didn't come from our tradition. We started reading alternate traditions. And we didn't agree with everything they said, but we thought, oh, wow, we've never looked at life. We've never looked at God. We've never looked at truth from this angle before. And it brought us out from just, well, we know what the company line is. We can tell you in 2 seconds what the company line is. It brought us out of that and into an idea of, let's explore grace. And if somewhere down the line, this is where people get scared. Somewhere down the line, you've got to think, is my glove big enough to stop me from walking off a cliff? I want to explore this idea. It's scary. It doesn't agree with what I was taught. But I want to explore this idea. But what if it's sheer heresy and I fall off a cliff? There's, you know, I walk so far that I go past the point of no return. And at some point, Wayne and I had to decide our God is big enough to keep us from walking off a cliff. You know? And he's good. And so we would go so far with an idea, and then we would say, no, this is not worth pursuing. It's silly. We don't want to do that. See, there are ends to the rabbit trail. That rabbit trail had a dead end. Not worth pursuing. Come back from that. But you learn something in the process of exploring that you never learn if you just sit there and say, I'm going to just believe what I believe. There is something to be learned just in the process of exploring. You hear what I'm saying?
Yes.
Even if you get to it and say, no, I don't agree with that. I can't go with that. There's something to be said for the process of doing the curiosity that takes you to that place. That is mental self-care. To let yourself be curious. The word that Wayne said over and over, and Wayne's not dead, sorry y'all. You're going to hear Wayne over and over. He is all up in my hard drive, and so I can't help it. But what Wayne said over and over about everything, explore the possibilities. Explore the possibilities. So any idea that comes along, any thought, any conversation, don't shut it off. Don't, you know, for your mental self-care, at least explore the possibilities, because there's magic in the exploration just in and of itself. Okay. This is me. This is where I've always been, and this is probably why I turned out to be a philosophy major in college. Always ask why. Always ask why. And I know you get tired of little two-year-olds. Why?
You think I did a great job of
those?
I got the look.
But I mean, how many of us have got little ones who they just, you know, and they'll get on a roll, and that's one thing. But as an adult, there's no end to a little kid's why. They just go because it's a game to them. But I have found that there's a place inside me that's not satisfied until I get to the last why. You know what I'm saying? The last why, and they go, I'm so smart, I'm asking why. And I'll get the answer, and I'm thinking, somehow I don't feel like that's the end of it. You see, here's what I'm saying. So you ask another why. You ask another why. And so here's some why questions. Why do I think the way I think in the first place? Why do I always assume that this idea is true? Where did I get the notion that that is a set in stone, solid, concrete idea? Where did I get, and why would it be so important that that one's true to me? It doesn't seem that important to everybody else. Why does that particular one, why is it so important to me? You keep digging, you see? And so you ask, why do I think the way I think? Why is it important for me to think that way? And why is it that alternate ideas threaten me or feel threatening to me? Why are they scary to me? Why do I want to shorten that conversation when somebody starts to go that way when I want to go that way? What is it about that that
gonna have, cause if that changes, then that has to change, and that has to change, and that has to change.
So one, you see what I'm saying?
Oh wow, that's gonna rearrange everything, and I have my life so nicely patterned. Now it's gonna, but that, isn't that what recovery is? Recovery is saying everything's up for grabs. Everything's up for discussion. So let's go ahead and ask that why. Why does that idea, that alternate idea, why does it threaten? Okay, so here's the last thing. Every once in a while I come up with a quote that I think, ooh, I like that quote. I'll put my name on that one. So here's one that I came up with. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Don't settle for knowledge that enables you to do a better job. Rather, seek wisdom that invites you to be a better you. Don't settle for knowledge that enables you to do a better job. Rather, seek wisdom that invites you to be a better you. I thought that might be true.
Say that one more time.
Where you need me to?
Instead, seek wisdom. This is the last
thing. Oh, that invites you to be a better you. Darren, I would say it 5 times.
It's just because I need to hear it.
Oh, okay. I'm finished. I don't know if this is fun for you all. This is where I live, how we think. But ideas do have consequences. What you think makes a huge difference. What you think is almost always translated into how you act and how you treat other people. So I think it's supremely important to think correctly. And here is the bullseye of correct thinking, I think. We're only as good as our God is. Guess what I'm saying? If you've got a mean, ugly God, you're going to probably live a mean, ugly life. But if you have a loving God, a God who loves unconditionally, full on, all the time, that's what you're going to be. Ideas have consequences. Huge, huge consequences. And so that, if you read the Old Testament, that is why God was so careful to explain to Moses and to Abraham and all those Old Testament, explain carefully who he was. This is who I am. Because he knew. Look at the tribes around them. They sacrificed their young ones. I mean, they did vile, they had temple prostitutes and all kinds of this stuff. They were only as good as their gods. They lived up to the standard of their God. Not the standard he set, but who he was. And God made it clear, this is who I am. He literally said, I am. He said, this is who I am. Knowing that they were going to live up to their God. You don't live down to your God, you live up to your God. And so ideas have unbelievable consequences. And so that's why I think mental